Next, there's been controversy about statins. We have a cardiologist, Dr. Bruce Liang, on the show. Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton. You can follow our show guest schedule and talk with us on Twitter at FaithWNPR. That's FaithWNPR. Statins have been in the news for good and for bad, so we decided to call on cardiologist Dr. Bruce Liang, head of the Pat and Jim Calhoun Cardiology Center and chief of cardiology at UConn Health Center in Farmington, Connecticut. Dr. Liang received his medical degree from Harvard. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Faith. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. And I wondered about this statin issue. First, they were talking about recently in the news this study that came out that said they were nervous from this study that statins can have an effect on cognitive function. Were you concerned about that at all?
No, I am not. I think common things happen commonly. So statin is one of the most widely used preventive medications in medicine today. So it's not unusual when you have that, and on the one hand, then you have people who have a cognitive function decline, for example, during aging process, and then they tend to associate the two together. But there's no proof that there is a cause and effect relationship. So I really would not be dissuaded from using or prescribing statin to our patients. The benefit really far outweighs the any potential risk.
When you're on a statin, I remember once a doctor joking with me, and he said, I essentially now can eat anything I want. And, you know, we roared. And so I wondered, is that true? Once you're on a statin, do you have to be concerned about your diet anymore?
That's an excellent question. You know, as a practicing cardiologist for the last almost 30 years now, then one of the hardest things that we have to do is to ask people to change their diet, because eating is a principal source of pleasure for many of us. And then to ask the folks to stay away from food that they have grown to like is exceedingly difficult. And so some people have said, well, you know, if we take statin, we can control the cholesterol, therefore we could indulge ourselves a little bit. Well, you know, the truth of the matter is that there is a little bit of that. Statin works by blocking the ability of our body to make new cholesterol. And the other principal source that contributes to the cholesterol level in the body is the diet, what we eat and what's absorbed in the stomach. And so you could, decrease the cholesterol by eating certain kind of food, you know, so that's one source. The other one is you can block the body from making its own cholesterol. It turns out that the latter, that is the body's ability to make cholesterol, is much, much more important in controlling the final cholesterol level, which belies the benefit of statin and the very potent ability of statin to lower the cholesterol.
I'm trying to read through all these words and think, is he telling us that those folks who are on statins can relax a bit about the food issue? What's the simple answer?
So the simple answer is that, yes, they can relax a little bit, but, you know, at the end, if you take statin and then still have dietary indiscretion, mm-hmm. then you're defeating the purpose of statin. So I would not recommend that.
Oh, okay.
But I do think that maybe you could relax a little bit, but not too much.
There was another study at the same time about that the cognitive function study came out, and it said statins, this is so typical of what we in the public read every week, these conflicting studies, statins help with depression. Is there any clinical evidence of that?
Well, depression is a multifactorial condition and has many, many causes. And, the environment factor certainly can cause depression, which in turn affect the biochemistry in the brain. And statin may have an impact on the biochemistry because of the cholesterol, which is a part of the cell membrane. So the brain are made up of cells, and in the surface of the cells are these cholesterol molecules, which makes up part of the membrane. And so there is some biochemical effect of statin, and depression is also quite common. And so finding an association does not necessarily mean a cause and effect. We have so many patients on statin, and if they feel better, they get better. Maybe that would elevate their mood and have a antidepressive effect from a mood standpoint, not necessarily from a biochemical standpoint, but we'll take whatever benefit we can get.
Exactly. I was a little confused about that study because I know that when people have heart attacks and then have surgery, that they often can be depressed during the recovery, and I wonder what causes that depression. Is it fear, or is it a biochemical thing?
Excellent question, Faith. I think it's more a concern with the change in their lifestyle, their condition. Mm-hmm. It's oftentimes when you talk to patients who had a heart attack or who had bypass surgery or angioplasty, then all of a sudden they realize that they got a serious conditions and they have to accept it and then deal with it. And oftentimes during the process of trying to accept a new condition, in a way kind of admit to one's own mortality. I mean, it's not something we think about until you are struck with a disease, mm-hmm. such as heart disease or cancer, something that's serious. And folks begin to have a bit of a wake-up call, and during that period, they could be depressed. But once they figure out they have a way to deal with it and get better, oftentimes we find that the patients begin to be less depressed. So it's kind of a process that patients go through. And, all these wonderful medications, including the statin, are exactly designed to so-called alter the natural history of some of these disease processes and make them live longer. So in a way, it's a secondary beneficial effect.
This is cardiology chief and head of the Calhoun Cardiology Center at the UConn Health Center in Farmington, Connecticut, Dr. Bruce Liang, and we're looking at heart health and disease. I've been reading a lot about the future of medicine, and there's, as you know, much discussion about things as small as molecules that will be inserted in the bloodstream and that can monitor internally what's going on in the body and send signals much more quickly as disease develops. How far away are we from something like that? I think about this especially with regard to women who present symptoms for heart attack in such an odd way. But for all people, how far away are we from that future?
The future is not that far away, thanks to the technology and science and the research. We here in the United States, we are still the leading experts on various aspects of science of medicine. But I want to make a plea to both the state and the federal funding agency to keep us ahead of the other countries in developing cutting-edge technology. So some of the technologies, as you alluded to, is we could take a tube of blood, and from that blood, we can actually ascertain and detect risk that a person has for developing heart disease or blockage from cholesterols. And this kind of things is already being done, but we have more to learn, and so it's in the not too distant future we'll be better able to diagnose the risk of future event from a blood test, for example, and then we can then the challenge would be to tailor a therapy to treat the condition. This is where personalized medicine, which is a term that we're going to hear increasingly going forward in the future. So you can tailor a therapy that will work for individual X but not for individual Y. And again, this is not too distant in the future. At UConn Health Center, we are fortunate to have the blessing of of Bioscience Connecticut, a vision, a wonderful vision and plan by our governor, Daniel Malloy, and the recent ability to have Jackson Lab, which is a world-famous research institute, to come into Farmington and work with us at UConn, not just the health center, but UConn stores, as well as Yale School of Medicine, to develop genomics and personalized medicine. And the goal there is really, just as I said, you could tailor a therapy that will work for individual X, but not for Y. So for individual Y, then you would design a different therapy. And so in the not too distant future, you know, we'll no longer have to worry about whether a drug works for everybody, because mm-hmm. we could tailor the therapy for each individual.
You and I have talked before about, and I just mentioned it, how odd women's symptoms are when they're presenting with some kind of heart problem. It's not as clear as it is with men. And one of the things I wonder about is that because we've studied women comparatively so little? I mean, we know exactly how men present, but we keep referring to these sort of weird and changing symptoms that women present with. Is that because we're not doing enough studies of women?
Yes, that's a partial answer to the question. That is correct. I would think that about 20, 30 years ago, if you look at any large clinical research, initially they only enroll men. But about 25 years ago, the government, which funds the National Institutes of Health, using taxpayers' money to get at better therapies for different kind of diseases, they said, hey, look, you know, we really got to include women as well as folks with different ethnic background, because mm-hmm. the ethnicity apparently has a role as well. There are certain genetic variants that are more prevalent in certain ethnic populations. So now when we start a study, we have to include as many as we can, and with absolute equity and equality in enrolling subjects. And so the landscape has changed and will continue to change, and we're going to get more information. In terms of women being different from men in the presenting symptoms, that is correct. Women can have stomach discomfort, back pain, or even a jaw pain. And sometimes they said, well, you know, I thought that maybe I have a toothache. They go to see a dentist, and the dentist checked them out, said, well, you know, you may have a little cavity here or there, but nothing that will cause this kind of discomfort. And then it turned out that it's actually a manifestation of a blockage in the circulation to the heart. Mm-hmm. And so you do have some so-called different presentations. So it's very important for the practitioners and for the public to realize that because, you know, heart disease sometimes just give you a little bit of a warning, and then a heart attack will strike, and that could be devastating. So got to pay attention to some of these warning signs.
Is there any truth to disease in the mouth, gum disease, and its effect on the heart? Can gum disease create more disease in the heart?
Yes, there is a link. The link is a modest to a moderate one. And we think the mechanism is that if the gum is inflamed, then it contributes to the inflammation in the whole body. And increased inflammation in the whole body can inflame the blood vessels in the heart, causing the blood vessels in the heart to be unstable and developing a plaque that rupture and have a clot sitting on it and causing a heart attack. So there is a link. So oral health is a preventive area that we need to focus on as well. And it could be as simple as brushing your teeth two times a day and flossing it every day to prevent the plaques from building up in the gum and between the teeth, which harbors the source of inflammation that can in turn cause a inflammation in the body.
I wonder why we don't have a system where dentists our dentists talk to our cardiology people or our internists and say, just wanted to let you know I'm finding inflammation in the gums of this patient. You might want to check out the heart. Wonder why we don't have that kind of communication going on.
Well, that's an excellent thought. We should take that as a lesson from this discussion.
or is it grant? Do you want to apply for a grant together?
Yes, yes. Good idea. Good idea. You're giving me all kinds of wonderful thoughts here.
Okay. So we know that people are always talking about having high blood pressure, but there are people who also suffer from something called orthostatic hypotension or dysautonomia, and that is super low blood pressure, so that when they're walking around, they have the opposite problem. Your blood pressure drops into your socks, as they refer to it, and it can make them lightheaded. It can make people pass out, but we never hear very much about this.
Yeah, it is a condition not uncommon in the elderly. In fact, there are two sides to that condition. One is, just as you said, as they get up, their blood pressure drops, and then they feel lightheaded. The other side of the coin is actually when they lie down, if you measure their blood pressure, they're actually high. They are actually could be very high. So it presents a challenge to the physicians treating these patients, because if you lower their blood pressure too much, trying to target their blood pressure mm-hmm. when they are supine, and then when they get up, then you're going to drop the blood pressure. So we don't have a pill that can distinguish between the posture aspect of the blood pressure. And so it is a challenge. But we do have a way of treating it. For example, we could give them a potent blood pressure medication at night, because then during nighttime they are supine, can lower their blood pressure when they are supine, typically when they are asleep at night. And by the time morning comes, that effect would have worn off to some extent. So when they get up and walk around, their blood pressure will not drop as much. So there's a way you could time the administration of some of these blood pressure medication to prevent this kind of a paradox.
I understand it also runs in families. It's not just about being elderly. I interviewed one of these doctors who deals with this super low blood pressure, and there were people of all ages in the office, apparently. So it goes across the age spectrum. And I gather it runs in families?
Yes. So yeah. There is a genetic or familial component to it. And there are certain genes that can regulate the blood pressure when a person changes posture. Normally, when that happens, your body compensates for it. For example, the blood vessel constricts in the lower extremity to propel more blood return to the heart, and therefore maintaining blood pressure. When you have certain genetic variants that affect that compensatory mechanism with the change in the posture, then the person will have a drop in the blood pressure. So yes, mm-hmm. you're absolutely right, and that can affect people who are younger and not just in the elderly.
Yeah. Let's talk about stents for a little bit.
Yes.
This has gotten confusing for me. It seemed like a miracle to me that we were using stents, and then there was some controversy, some studies, people saying, oh, it depends on what kind of stent. What's going on there? What kind of stents should people be making sure they get if they need them?
Another very good question. Stents were developed in the late 80s. Originally, in the 70s, we had a thing called the balloon angioplasty, which is basically you put a little balloon there that's deflated and then inflated to three or four times the atmospheric pressure. And what this balloon does is it crushes the plaques, which block the circulation in the heart, and then open up the blood circulation. And what we find is that about 30 to 40% of the patients after the balloon angioplasty will develop reoccurrent blockage. Hmm. So people are saying, well, you know, that's not good. You know, you keep poking a person's artery and try to inflate this and deflate this multiple times. So they figure out if they could put these stents, which are nothing more than a metal meshwork, and then the stent will prop it open, the artery, so that after the balloon angioplasty, the stent will keep the artery open, and because it's a metal support structure. And so that works, and it blocks so-called re-stenosis or reoccurrence of the blockage to about 20%, 18 to 20%. So that's an improvement. You went from about 30 to 40% and almost cut it in half. And so those stents are what we call bare metal stents. Now, the problem with bare metal stents is that it then is prone to develop a reaction. A body's blood vessel will react to it, and so you still have about 20% reoccurrence. And now mm-hmm. comes the next events. In about 2003, 2004, they make these medication stents. So they coated these metal stents with drugs locally, and these drugs will block the body's reaction, and then that cuts down the restenosis rate to about 3 or 4%. So it's right now the medication stents are mostly what we use, because 96-97% of the time you don't have to deal with reoccurrence of the blockage, or so-called restenosis. Now, there's no such thing as a free lunch. So with the medication stent, there's a small risk that the stent will get thrombosed, will have a clot that develop in the middle of it. So patients who get the medication stent needs to be on aspirin and Plavix. These are so-called blood thinners, at least for 6 to 12 months to block this clotting process that can occur in the medication stents. And if you talk to patients who are taking both aspirin and Plavix as blood thinners, they can tell you that they bruise a little more easily. They, mm-hmm. if they're bumping themselves just around the table in the kitchen, they get a little black and blue mark. Mm-hmm. And, so that's relatively minor and maybe cosmetic. But sometimes you do get some serious internal bleeding. So it doesn't come without any side effects. But overall, it's still better than the bare metal stents.
Thank you so much. I hope you'll come back again, because I have 50 more questions to ask you. Thank you,
Faith. This has been a wonderful opportunity.
Cardiology Chief and Head of the Calhoun Cardiology Center at UConn Health Center in Farmington, Connecticut, Dr. Bruce Liang, a look at heart health and disease. The Faith Middleton Show airs at 3 and 9 p.m. on Facebook. Search The Faith Middleton Show. Our talented producers are Jonathan McNichol and senior producer Lori Mack. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.